Welcome to our sixth annual London Design Festival event and podcast. My name is John Coldham and I'm a partner in the intellectual property team at Gowling WLG. My particular focus is on brands and designs, so I'm very proud to be chairing our unique London Design Festival event and this associated podcast. In our designs practice at Gowling WLG, we are lucky to work with some fantastic designers, big and small, who've created some wonderful things. Sometimes they're big, change-the-world designs, and sometimes they're low-key, simple designs that are perhaps just as likely to have a positive effect on consumers' lives. This is the power of design. It can be subtle, but one of the key purposes of good design is to make people happier. We are honoured to organise our annual event with incredible design consultancy, Tangerine. Martin Derbyshire, its founder and CEO, is one of the most sought-after speakers in design. Tangerine's mission statement is groundbreaking innovation and design that makes consumers happy and businesses profitable. It also sums up what we're trying to achieve today. Groundbreaking innovation means more than a clever idea. It means an idea that will make consumers happy. But what does that mean? Something that will work for more people, more accessible, either in terms of disability or age or something else. Something that will inspire more people to try it out or use it. Something that will make people's lives easier or happier. Perhaps a device that replaces a repetitive task in an easy and cost-effective way, or a different way of approaching something that just makes it more intuitive and joyful. Good design makes people happy, and with an appreciation of the difference, people are more loyal to the brand and more likely to understand the need to charge more to support the design work involved. The purpose of this session is to speak to some real experts in design about how they approach it and how they have made their practices or projects a success. Good design is profitable. Make things that appeal to more people or just work better and people will pay for it. And this is where Gowling WLG comes in. I hate to break it to you, but there are people out there who are not willing to put in the hard yards and will take advantage of other people's good design. So it's important to protect your ideas and designs early. There is a plethora of ways to do that. The design protection elements are set out in some detail in our free booklet, The Designs for Life Guide, which is downloadable from our website at gowlingwlg.com/designsforlife. Or give us a call. We love to hear from designers and don't charge to get to know you and work out if and how you might need some assistance. So the purpose of today's event and podcast is to explore particular areas of design. This session focuses on design challenges in the modern world. One aspect of our discussion will explore how great design can improve the lives of different generations. An ageing population and a lack of affordable housing for young people means that it's now not uncommon to find two or three generations living under the same roof or rubbing shoulders in the workplace. The government has acknowledged the importance of solving the issues of an ageing society in its industrial strategy, whilst brands and designers alike are having to adapt to the shifting consumer habits of a multi-generational world in order to create innovative solutions that meet the needs of different age groups. According to research carried out by insurance company Aviva, the number of young adults living with parents has increased 32% between 2005 and 2015. The number of young adults living with parents by 2025 is expected to stand at 3.8 million. But where does this leave designers? Design that focuses on the multi-generational world is one thing, but design also needs to keep the different potential users and consumers in mind when it's created. The broader the appeal of your product, the more you will sell. With no further ado, I'd like to introduce my panel of speakers on this podcast. First up, we've got Johnny Gray, a legendary kitchen designer, who will introduce himself in a moment. We also have Adam Thomas, who has been listed as one of Britain's most influential disabled people in the Power 100 list of 2015, and is also a kitchen designer. Matt Dyson is the inventor of a product that I certainly wish existed a few years ago, called the Rocket, and I'll let him explain what that is. And finally, Martin, who I've already mentioned, who's the founder of the design consultancy Tangerine. Johnny, why don't you go first and explain a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I came to kitchens from a completely different direction. It was more, I was mentored actually by an aunt of mine who was a food writer. And she opened my eyes to how restricted and limited people's concept of kitchens were in the 60s and 70s. So you get all these advertising companies who do wonderful things, but it turns out they're really telling us that kitchens have got to be cleaned up, dehygienized, and I think, and what they call fitted. A rebel was born. I object to that because it's got a very limited view of design, of culture, and the thing you referred to at the beginning, which is an emotional connection with where you are and how a space supports you. I trained as an architect and eventually started exploring the parameters of kitchen making rather than design. And then I came up with this idea that you'd make kitchens out of something like freestanding furniture, but with hidden and very good ergonomics. And from there, I've sort of continued my
Yaxit. We'll hear more about your rebellion in a minute. Adam, over to you.
My name's Adam Thomas. I'm spinally injured full-time wheelchair user. I was injured in a road traffic accident. And I say that from the point of view, for the first 17 and a half years of my life, I didn't really think about accessible design at all. I didn't think about society or the way society was built, the built environment. And then overnight, I became a full-time wheelchair user. And all of a sudden, found out that because of the way society was designed, I couldn't access it and I was being left out. In 1981, I had no basic human rights. I had no right to education. I had no right to transport. I had no right to social life, in the fact that I physically wasn't allowed to go and see a film because I was a fire hazard. I wasn't allowed to go to a rock concert because I was a fire hazard. If someone asked me to leave a restaurant, I had no rights. So if a restaurateur asked me to leave, they could call the police and get me arrested. And it was only since 1995 that disabled people started having equality through the Disability Discrimination Act. I was a kitchen designer before and had just trained as a kitchen designer from when I was 17. And then afterwards, I was very, very lucky that I had one of the few employers that would even consider employing a disabled person. And I went back to work with him. He spent a fortune of his own money remodeling his showroom and making it accessible. And sort of through that loyalty, I've stuck with him sort of ever since. And although I've changed the way I work now, I still do all his design work for him.
Great. Matt.
Hi, I'm Matt Dyson. In a previous life, I was worked in advertising as an art director and then retrained to become a teacher and taught product design in schools and colleges for 20 years before, 3 years ago, giving it all up to start up Rocket, which is our startup business and is based around the product, our launch product, if you excuse the pun, which is a rocket-shaped baby rocker that attaches to any pushchair or pram and gently rocks it so mums and dads don't have to. And we've spent the last 2.5-3 years developing the product with the help of the Design Council Spark program, who gave us some fantastic mentoring and also some cash to develop our IP, to create the tooling for the product and to get it to market. And we launched it in October last year, and we're now selling in over 30 countries worldwide and have produced over 30,000 rockets to date. So that's my background.
Wow, what a success story already. Martin.
Well, John, thank you for the introduction. I guess this is the fifth year I've been doing this.
Yeah.
Sixth year,
yeah.
Oh man. And you know, I'm one of the two founders of Tangerine. I've been working in the business for 30 years or so on very different kinds of projects and different kinds of clients. Largely, they're very commercially driven, and so multi-generational design is quite a tricky subject. It's, you know, it's not necessarily very commercially compelling in many ways, and design is about context and often drilling in to determine who the end customer is, and creating something which is right for that end customer is, you know, is the goal that most of our clients are looking for. But we like to be disruptive, and I'm never happy with just doing that. So I'll share some work that we've done today, going back to 1998 with a group called Design for Ability, who were part of what was then Central St Martins and now the University of the Arts London, looking at how you develop design that works and provides increased ability to people. So I'll feature and show a little project that we worked on, which I think actually did really raise the profile of issues for designing for people with limited abilities. And multi-generational design, I think, will in the future become a more applicable subject matter, particularly as products become much more software or interface based, where the diversity of users will naturally grow. And I'm going to show a bit of our work with a client called Bluebell, who are a startup. The company name is Kinedo, and they're developing a smart baby monitor system, which will, similar to Rocket, but from a different approach, help parents get their babies to sleep better and provide support and information that will really help parents be better parents.
So Matt's rocket will get them to sleep, and then your client will
keep them asleep. We'll make sure
sounds
they
like,
stay asleep.
Sounds like the winning ticket.
Yeah. So we do connect. This isn't a stitch-up, though.
So obviously some of you are coming from having some specific experience of multi-generational or multi-user worlds, and others of you less so. But I think for me, one of the things that strikes me as being the sort of starting point of this sort of topic is actually sort of ease of use, either ease of access or ease of use. You know, if you make something that's of broader appeal, by definition, people who would might be the default person they have, a designer has in mind, would still be able to use it and enjoy the product. It just means it appeals to more people, be it accessibility or age or whatever it is.
Exactly.
Why don't each of you tell me where ease of use is, or accessibility as you look at it, features in your main design brief? Martin described it as being multi-generational, as being niche, but I wonder if you step back one level to ease of use. Martin,
it's a niche market, I think, from a commercial perspective, I guess. See, and the question is, when does that change? When do attitudes
change? Adam and I think about this in the same way.
Yeah. I think, if you just look at statistics, if you just take impairment and disability, there are 13 million disabled people in this country, one in five of the population. If you bring the grey market into that, it's 50% of the market. So if you're not designing with that base of client, you're cutting out half the market. The statistics on the buying power of what's called the purple pound is $249 billion a year. And that's in our market, in the housing stroke kitchen market. You open that up to the grey market, and I think it's something like $320 billion. It's a massive, massive market. And you're just shooting yourself in the foot if you don't design multi-generational, particularly in our field of kitchens, bathrooms, housing, etc.
Can I slightly also widen the discussion, which is something based on Adam and I have done judging and teaching together. I think I can speak for you and say that what's really happening is interesting is the word accessible design, I think, will gradually start to fade out as multi-generational design takes hold. And I think, John, this is kind of one of the reasons why you've put this headline on this particular event today. And it's really interesting because I think what it is, instead of it talking about focusing on the disability, it talks about ability. And particularly, it's a lovely inclusive thing, which is, of course, the original idea of it. Because it involves all generations, in theory you'd be able to have something that a small child can use, and maybe by accident, that's come about through thinking about that, and then it can apply to everybody. So you start to destigmatize things, there's so many other aspects of working design.
I absolutely do back that up because I spent 25, 30 years of my career banging my head against the wall trying to get people to wake up and listen to accessible design. And people, builders, house builders, whoever, look at it and think, well, this is how much it's going to cost to build a house. To make it accessible is going to cost another $5,000. Why would I do that? But if everyone is building the house in the first place accessible, that is the baseline cost to start with. But equally, multi-generational really came about through a conversation with a few people, Johnny being one of them, where we're literally saying, we're having this conversation about, I've been banging my head against the wall 25 years, call it something else, and all of a sudden the light bulb came on in my head. If we call it multi-generational is basically accessible design, but under another name. But it actually means we are designing for everybody. If you design if you take a housing association who are providing 2,000 kitchens a year for their clients, if every time an elderly person moves into that property or becomes elderly or disabled, they have to put in another kitchen X amount. If you've designed a kitchen in the first place, which is accessible, it doesn't matter who the end user is. So if you then equate those figures over a time period, every housing association will save a fortune. There is a total economic and social benefit for this, and the other aspect is social.
One of the reasons we worked on the Design for Ability project is that certainly at that point in time it was very difficult to do something as interesting. Mm-hmm. Really, because we're being commercially driven in many ways, and so we're getting to work on the things that our clients think are the right things for them. And in this case, one of the real drivers for it was we worked on a project that was from a research fellow who was looking at people with disabilities from a psychographic approach. So she was actually looking at their lifestyle and behaviour rather than their physical impairment, and then trying to create from that themes that could guide and shape design. And so it was interesting from a designer point of view. But from the other perspective was, one of the other research fellows was looking at the way the National Health Service was designing and specifying aids for people. And that key piece of research determined that 50% of the people given those aids didn't use them because they coded them so poorly. And, you know, they were just, I mean, like, utterly unacceptable. So they were designing for a price point, which in the end became irrelevant because half of them weren't used. So they could have, you know, added 50% to the bill cost, still satisfied more customers. But nobody thinks about those terms. So in this case, we had the opportunity to then, you know, develop a design and put it out in the media, do a launch event, which got, you know, some publicity around it. And Beg MP, who was the first disabled member of parliament, came to launch, and then I got interviewed on Does He Take Sugar with Tammy Gray Thompson, just, you know, talking about this subject matter. So it's important.
I mean, that is one of the issues that disabled people have got, is that big companies look at things at short term.
Yes.
So again, if our argument was, when I was first injured, I was being given a wheelchair which cost about £400, which I was basically damaging, smashing up a wheelchair every 6 months, which was costing the state £400. A wheelchair that was designed in 1956, and it weighed 56 pounds. Our argument was, give us a new generation chair, which weighs about 12 pounds, and will probably last me about 8 to 10 years. And we'd stay, but because they're how they do their budgets, they don't look at it holistically or the wider approach.
Looking at you know, some of the things you talked about are specific, as I said, but some of the things are more general. Matt, tell me about how you've looked at sort of usability. You've got a product which the idea sounds so simple, but presumably the use of it has to be simple, because I know when I was a tired parent, still am, but you know, at that particular point, it's very important that you can just use it. So tell me a bit about how you came up with the sort of ease of use parts of your product.
Absolutely, and you know, that was one of the key criteria. You know, sleep deprived parents, you know, obviously you're trying to get your baby to sleep in the middle of the night and such like, you want a product that's going to be really easy to use, and you don't want lots of bells and whistles. And we did lots of focus groups to look at that. And the original idea with Rocket was that it was going to have more features and perhaps even an app control, you know, sound and all sorts. But the focus groups sort of said straight away that no, actually, what we want is that the key benefit to be it rocks your baby to sleep. We don't really need the other bits. And we were very sort of conscious of that when we designed it. You know, probably the most fiddly part of actually using the Rocket is attaching it securely to the pram or pushchair. It needs to be very firmly attached so that the vibration resonates through the structure of the pushchair. And we did that through a sort of two-fix system. So you attach the bracket, and we wanted that to be a single operation. So you attach the bracket to the pushchair, and you never need to take it off again. And then the Rocket itself then clips in, and when you don't need it, or you're taking it in the boot of the car, you can just remove it, stow it until you next need it. And in terms of the user interface, there's only two controls on the product. So there's an on-off button and a speed control. And again, we just wanted that to be intuitive and as easy to use and understand as possible.
So part of your design process was actually almost going backwards. Some people would design something and make it more and more advanced. Actually, you were stripping it away.
Absolutely, yeah. We had quite a sophisticated prototype at one point, and yeah, we in the end we did strip away the superfluous elements and, you know, make it as simple as possible. And obviously that helped with the costs as well. But
How's it powered?
It's powered by standard AA batteries, four AAs. You can use rechargeable batteries in there as well.
Can it send adults asleep in a wheelchair? It's multi-generational.
We can try that later, yeah. See if it does.
It's interesting. It's a very interesting product.
Yeah, it's another aspect of the multi-generational thing. It's obviously we're designing products for babies, but they're being operated by parents. And we all know that our babies are our most precious things. And this obviously leads to the sort of safety concerns, and parents are very, very cautious when they're buying products, especially for a very young baby. And so we worked very carefully when we were safety testing. We wanted to test it above and beyond the requirements. So it's been tested to 0 to 36 month toy standard, even though it's not a toy. But we just wanted really to reassure ourselves that it was perfectly safe, but also to reassure mums and dads that it was safe, and if an older sibling got hold of it, because it does look quite toy-like and fun, I mean, if they got hold of it, there's no harm could come to them. You know, so sort of thinking in terms of the perception of safety as well was quite an important
The other thing about a product like yours is, of course, the day-to-day users of baby products, for example, tend to be the parents, but actually you have the occasional grandparent help or whatever, and I know from, you know, personal experience, sometimes explaining how all the different baby gadgets work for an occasional visit by a grandparent or other relation is not always straightforward. So you say, oh, don't bother with that, I'll do it for you and set it up, whereas presumably the idea of your product is it's just as easy for a first-time user as it is for
absolutely, yes, somebody yes. else. And we you know, sell additional brackets, so grandparents, and obviously there's a growing trend with grandparents doing the childcare. A grandparent can have it on their stroller, and the rocket can just be transferred easily to, from stroller to stroller.
It's a very interesting parallel here with kind of what we're doing with the 4G kitchen, which I'll talk about later. But it's partly been driven by Professor Peter Gore and Newcastle University's Aging Research Centres, which is how they identify that the kitchen is a place where people really need a support when they're aging, and particularly through safety. And actually, we're going to build an app, we're going to build a sort of language around how, so you can talk to, you know, Alexa about whether or not, you know, you're doing the right thing or, but I mean, it's a very real issue. And one of the bits of education that Professor Peter Gore talks about when he gives his talks is, he looks at accident statistics, and you'd be absolutely staggered how people get injured. I mean, even from things like tablecloths, 60 people a year go to casualty or something. I mean, so there are absurdities, but also there are some other major things that probably we can do, particularly with cooking and safety. So I'm very interested to hear your, you know, I'd be interested to hear more about how you carried out your focus group research.
I mean, it was a lot of credit I should really give to the Design Council. We, as I said before we started recording, I had no experience of bringing a product to market, and none of the team did at that point. And, you know, the Design Council really supported us with the mentoring and gave us lots of advice. I mean, their mantra was test, 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 and also good enough is good enough, you know, not to sort of keep going until, you know, somebody else brings something up to market. So, I mean, in terms of the focus groups, we ran a series of those ourselves. We had very little money. We ran those ourselves, but we had to be very careful to make sure that they weren't biased in any way. And my co-founder Nick Webb has a PhD and has done lots of research himself. So, you know, he was instrumental in making sure that research was done as carefully as possible. But it was quite interesting. One of those focus groups that some of the parents were suggesting, oh, it's rocking quite rigorously, you know, is that safe? And there was a discussion around that, and we've done lots of testing on the amount of force and vibration that a baby experiences when they're being wheeled along in a pushchair and pram. And if we replicated that through the rocket, it would have been even greater vibration for parents. But because you don't sort of sit and watch a baby when you're wheeling them along and see how their heads are moving and how they're sort of vibrating as they're moving, you don't appreciate that. Actually, that's quite a...
Did you alter the vibration in any way? Is it a sort of pattern?
Yeah,
we worked through.
We did exactly that. We limited the top end of the speed just to make sure that parents' perception, again, of the safety...
But is it a constant vibration?
It is a constant vibration. We have to incorporate a bit of a speed boost at certain angles just to get the momentum going. But the actual vibration can be altered, though, you know, so it runs between about four hertz and 8 hertz, and, you know, that's well within the field working there.
So are you expecting a parent to observe what suits their particular child and vary it?
That's right. I mean,
wow, it's quite something.
It's to do with the structure itself. So the pram, obviously you can get very lightweight strollers or very heavy prams. Some have suspension, some don't. So it's getting the resonant frequency. Obviously, we don't blind our customers with those sorts of terms, but getting the resonant frequency of the pushchair with the baby in it at the right level, so it gives a really lovely, gentle, low-frequency rock.
And the way John's hands are vibrating when he holds it. He's trying to stop it vibrating.
Ease of use, I found the on-off switch very quickly.
It's really interesting. Isn't it? Have you held it, Martin?
I've seen it before, yes, I must admit.
Because it's not,
Matt kindly came to our office
anything
and gave
I've
a demo and a talk about
really.
It.
I mean, I think because you can't see what's going on, but you're just having this kind of...
It's almost like a gyroscope, isn't it?
Yeah,
you hold
it is.
A gyroscope. The speed control is there, really, just for a parent to find the one that works best for their baby. But ideally, it's that resonant frequency of the pushchair that's important, and you get that lovely, gentle rock, rather than it being a sort of high-frequency buzz.
keep turning up till they sleep.
Was the first child you tried it out on?
That was my brother-in-law Nick. His daughter Abby. He was the inventor, so I can't take credit for that. But he invented it. He's a I was going to say a mad scientist. So I hope he's not listening. But he took an old printer apart in desperation one night and soldered a speed control circuit, lashed some nuts and bolts onto the spindle of the motor, got the object working, and it rocked Abby's pusher. She stayed asleep the next day when they were out shopping and such like. So it was a light bulb moment, and then he showed me, knowing I was sort of a bit disillusioned with teaching at the time and wanted a new challenge. So I, along with another colleague, Matt Sparrow, turned his invention into the rocket.
Martin, how have you approached it? Either talk about your specific multi-generational products or more generally.
Well, I think we should talk about Bluebell, partly because, you know, we, Tangerine, are pursuing this on an equity-only basis. So we're working together with a startup who are looking for funding and gathering funding as we go along. It sounds like a wonderful product because it has tremendous capability and potential in terms of it can monitor all sorts of vital statistics of the baby, but you need to shift thinking away from it just being an alarm, really, to being a smart.
Is it a baby monitor? What is the product?
It's a monitoring. It's basically involves a series of elements. So it involves what we call the baby button, which is a device that attaches to the baby's baby grow. When you put them to sleep, you can leave it on them all day because the device is wireless and you can utilize it around the home. Then there's a parent wearable, which is essentially a wristband that you can monitor, and then there is a hub, in a nursery hub, which provides charge capability for the two wearables and provides a night light and plays lullaby. And then of course there's an app, and this series of elements can be used by any number of different customers. They can be, you know, they can be either of the parents, they could be the au pair or the babysitter, they could be a grandparent. So the product and the system has to be understandable by a really wide range of people with different language skills and capabilities. And of course, as with all of these things, there's a temptation to want to sell it on its technology capability.
It's like a kind of behavioural Fitbit.
Yeah, it is, really, absolutely. Fitbit. But it's focused on helping people become better parents, really. So the thinking behind it is that you want this to help people improve the sleep pattern of their child, and in so doing then get a little bit more of their life back in a way. It frees them in part from, you know, what we've all experienced. So, you know, hopefully really.
Do you think it's true to say that with smart technology that quite a bit of the sort of focus is really about providing more precision of behaviour or precision of performance? Would that be right?
Well, yes, in a way. I think what you want to get here is better feedback from the system. So you don't want to be alarmed by it, you want to be reassured by it. So you want to shift the thinking from alarm to reassurance. And also, this involves machine learning, so the valuable component over time won't be the electronic devices, it will actually be the data that you collect and how you can improve the feedback that you give to the parents through the growing collection of the data. And of course, that data is then going to be shared between parent groups as well. So not only will you have the support from the device, but you'll then have support from the web, either to a parent group who will become members and advocates for the product itself, or to specialists if you are in a dire situation and you really need to get help quickly and want to understand.
It sounds in the sort of same way that Matt tried to strip a lot of the sort of stuff you just talked about out of his product. You've kept it in yours.
Yeah.
Or quite the opposite, it's the point of yours. So how have you approached that usability for the, as you say, the occasional user or the different languages and so on? What were your sort of things you had in mind?
Everything essentially is driven by icons in terms of feedback. So there are a very simple set of icons that are designed to feedback via the display. Because it's an entry product, we've tried to keep the price point down by simplifying the technology as much as possible. So Fitbit is a good example where they've been intelligent in terms of doing that. And we've worked quite hard to try and ensure that we don't introduce any unnecessary fuss. So the feedback to parents is a gently blinking light, breathing light, which changes frequency and changes colour to gently communicate to you and give you a sense of what your baby is doing. And of course, if something alarming happens, it will tell you relatively quickly that something is alarming happening. And then with the app, you can enter data you choose to enter. So you can enter feeding information, you can enter toilet information if you want to, and you can build up a much better picture of how things are going. And of course, you can also then check on and make sure that that's been happening in the background if you're away from it, so you get a growing amount of information. But certainly simplicity is the crucial part of it. We need to ensure that it's really easy to understand and easy to use, and avoid unnecessary gadgets or anything unnecessary. It needs to be completely subliminal and in the background and reassuring and not shouting about itself or what it is. So it's a tricky design job in terms of getting the look and feel right, getting the iconography right, getting the interaction right, and also limiting the spend, because essentially it's a startup and they need to get it to market, and you know, you need to find an appropriate
way. So is this mostly for people with sort of problem?
Not at all, it's for anyone. It's for anybody who really wants support in trying to learn about the behavioural patterns of their children and try and improve that through tracking it, monitoring it. So at the least invasive end, it's purely there as a reassurance thing, so you know what your baby's doing when you're not with them. And at the other end, you can become, if you are a really implicated parent, as the marketeers would call it, you can dive in and monitor everything that goes on. And
so if I was a designer doing multi-generational, I'd be opening it up and seeing whether you could include this for older people as well.
You could do as well. You can then...
And I'm already thinking, once you've got the system in place, there's loads of different directions you could take it out.
Yes,
I mean, the monitoring of older people is, and people with dementia, etc., is massive.
I was going to say, I think that's a huge issue.
And we've given this a kind of proposition of parenting made simpler, but of course you can stick a different word on the front if you really want to,
yeah.
And relate to a different market.
Which actually brings us back to what we're here to talk about. I mean, it all ties together, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, all
the
stuff to do with whether you're focusing on babies or kitchens or adults or pensioners, that the point is that the simpler something is, the more accessible it is, to go back to that word, the more you can use one product in more than one market.
Isn't it also the fact that once you start thinking about something could be done for one group, if you think multi-generationally, you realise that it may have fantastic suitability for the other end of the group. I mean, I think this is actually a very, very good example of what we'd like to see multi-generational design, or why we'd like to see it become a category or a way of thinking, I think.
And that's why for Martin's idea of making it simple to use, the parents using it might actually be capable of having a slightly higher level of complication, just because, you know, they tend to be younger than the older people using it, obviously, and so on. But if you do make it simple, then it makes it easier to transition it over to the grey market.
I think it could translate in many ways, but certainly we encourage Kinedo. I mean, two of them are doctors and one of them is a data analyst, and they're all very excited about the capability of this system. But from a brand perspective, we want to drill them down to be very clear about what you're tackling and what you're launching, because you want to put your money on the nose of the thing that is the market entry point. And in this case, if you can really improve sleep and help parents get better sleep, that is the golden opportunity if you get it right. And of course, but the technology and its application is very wide, potentially. And of course, the more data you gather, the nice thing there, the system will be in place and it'll be a straightforward thing to think about how you translate that data to something else.
Yes, the difference, I mean, really, you're working with just a client comes to you with a concept and you're working through. We're coming from it more of a design principle. I think we're saying is that we want to go right back to when teachers are in secondary school teaching design students, etc., and arts and design, etc., right the way through. And I still believe, I mean, you might correct me on this, architects can do a 6-year degree course and they don't do one day's training in accessible design, which I just find phenomenal when these architects are going to be in charge of doing the built environment for the next 50, 100 years with some of the buildings they're designing, and they're not being lectured in accessible design at all. And all, as I know, we're now calling it multi-generational design.
Mm. I come from a sector which is a pretty ignorant sector. It's commercially driven, the kitchen industry, and they pay lip service to design, and most of the design is done on the engineering front end, and spatial design is almost non-existent.
Johnny, why don't you tell us a bit about your four-generational kitchen?
Thank you. This came out because I had a conversation with Kevin MacLeod when we were doing some filming about probably now 7 or 8 years ago, and he said, "Look, why is kitchen design so poor?" I kind of have seen, you know, particularly at the high end, which is the end that I've come from, you know, where there's plenty of money, plenty of resources. And he came, he then asked me, he said, I'm going to put on an event at Grand Designs Live, and I want you to come and talk and explain, you know, explain yourself out of this one. I'm going to invite other people from the industry to do the same. So I, about six of us turned up, and it's quite surprising in a way, but I sort of had a sort of overnight kind of moment, you know, down the scene commission. I thought, right, what we need is to create a kitchen design profession where there's a commitment to design. So I made a sort of speech saying this is what we should be doing, and I think people were slightly surprised by this, but somebody from Bucks New University was in the audience. And they said, look, if you're so clever, you come and do it here. So we did, and Adam now teaches on the course. And for me, the second Damascene conversion was kind of hearing Adam talk, where I realised I'd been applying all this kind of quite specific design knowledge I've been building up over the years from working with neuroscientists, all the rest of them, to basically being able to use custom design for if you like, accessible design for disability, which we had completely ignored. And then I realised, in fact, you can kind of do it wider than that. But another one of those lovely kind of unexpected moments was at a kitchen industry conference, and Professor Peter Gore turns up and talks about ageing in a way that I've never heard anybody talk about before. So we've kind of put this together a bit by just natural kind of process of making design more sophisticated, of kitchens more sophisticated, by a great will of people wanting to solve a whole series of problems. And his view is that, and that now the government view, we've got a meeting with the government, Department of Health and Social Care tomorrow, trying to build a consortium for the 4G kitchen. But the bottom line is that the last thing that gets you out of your own home and turns you into a care home is when you can't cook for yourself and or eat yourself. So the government knows it costs a lot of money, so the government is suddenly interested. And so here we are with the sort of early principles of this. And we've been teaching this to our third year students at Bucks New University. But we've also been working with NICA. Now, NICA, the National Innovation Centre of Ageing, should I just sort of say this out?
Yeah.
You probably know. Was set up with government funding by George Osborne about 2.5 years ago. They're just building a research centre and a big building in Newcastle. And they want a project that they can start to use some of their, like some of the research that's come out of the National Centre for Ageing in Newcastle. There are something like 400 researchers up there, and a lot of the actual research never gets anywhere. So that's the vision of NICA. And so we're part of trying to deliver some domestic version of NICA. And it's particularly of concern because of the rising number of people with dementia. I went to the first launch at the Building Research Establishment about 6 weeks ago, the first prototype dementia home. Adam and I viewed it together, and we were slightly kind of surprised how much it was really at the beginning, because we have quite a lot of information now that we could apply. So there's dual problems in both directions. It's not being applied, architects and designers don't know about it, we need to do more research, we need to build prototypes, but we're starting, and so, you know, that's what I'll be talking about today.
So is that sort of particular designs, as in a particular type of hob or a particular type of island or things like that, or is it more teaching people about a whole different approach?
It's teaching, it's a totally different concept for designing. When I did the Athletes Village,
at London 2012?
Yeah, very lucky to get a contract doing all the design work for that project on the accessible kitchen side, multi-generational kitchen side. But
presumably they had to be used for the Paralympics as well, so there was a particular need for...
I was involved with the London plan that was started under Ken Livingstone and then finished under Boris. We've actually now got some very good building regs in place in London, where other cities are copying, which is fantastic. But London is the best. I mean, any major project that's being built now has to have 10% wheelchair accessible property, which is making a huge difference. So on a social level, that for the first time means that a disabled person, if they're living in Liverpool but they see a job advertised for a lawyer in London, there's a fair chance they're going to be able to find a property, because up until about 10, 15 years ago, disabled people couldn't move around the country, follow work or jobs, because there wasn't the accommodation in place. So for the Olympic Village, I actually came up with the design concepts, which I'd love to talk to you about somehow, about how one patents a design concept. But it comes back to my passion is social housing, and it's very easy to have a private client with money that you can do the most beautiful bespoke design. But how do we design, come up with a concept where we can put into social housing and roll it out mass production? Well, I came up with this design concept where 2/3 of the kitchen can be fitted and anyone can use it. And then we have one section which is put onto rise and fall, which then means that if you're an elderly person who can't bend, or if you're a wheelchair user and you need lower worktops, or whatever your need is, it makes the whole kitchen fully accessible. And it's a great design concept to work to. And this is the thing, I spent, again, 25 years really trying to get the kitchen industry, as Johnny was saying, to wake up to this huge market. And it is a massive, massive market. That the bathroom industry, 15 years ago, came together as an organisation and said, we are not designing bathrooms for the grey market and the purple market. And they came together, and all of a sudden now, you just go into a bathroom showroom, you see a beautifully designed shower tap or whatever, a basin mix or whatever, but that's been ergonomically designed for people with arthritis or whatever, but it's beautiful. So it's a piece of artwork to look at, but everyone can use it. And it's just recently that the kitchen industry is, and through a lot of the work that Bucks University and Johnny and others are doing, that the industry is slowly waking up to...
I think I compare us a bit to lighting design, which has started as a profession. I'm sorry, I think we can almost now define it as a profession, although I'm not sure whether they necessarily would say agree with that. But you look at the incredible way they move forward in professionalism, and I'd like to think that we could do that with the kitchen sector. But going back specifically to what some of the things you're saying, I think we've got quite a lot of information here now that we want to sort of package together. And the multi-generational title gives us a lot of scope to do that. And I'll talk in, shortly about, how some of these very specific things we can do. But one of the things I think that Nikon wanted me to be a design ambassador for was to try and bring a sense of enjoyment to being in the kitchen, not just about function. And when I said to you earlier about the unfitted kitchen and turning bits of furniture into having a hidden connection through ergonomics, that's kind of what I'd like to do with the word happiness. And I'll go into a bit about how we get to those points. But there's some lovely things you can do to start that process off. So when people ask me, what's your key design principle? I say, it's all about eye contact. But what's kitchen design got to do with eye contact? Because you have to use a surface. But it springs from that, I think, which is that we want to enjoy being together in the kitchen. It's more the social side of being in the kitchen is as important, possibly more so, than almost anything else.
And that links very nicely with that multi-generational, interacting with each other, various generations of a family in the kitchen,
yeah.
And it being a social activity.
It is, absolutely. And it is incredible. I mean, if you think about, as a person, you're in your own home or with your family in a home, and you can't even reach to get a mug out of a cupboard, let alone put the kettle on. So you're always having to ask somebody else to do the most basic of tasks. With good design, we can make people fully independent in the home again, if we understand impairment and ergonomics and the way we want to use the kitchen, because the kitchen really is the hub of the home. It's where we're spending more and more time in
the room,
room than anywhere else.
And I've just seen it in my lifetime go from this quite sort of grim sort of backbone facing north where men basically didn't go, we all know about it. It's completely wonderful now. We've got this open opportunity. The other thing that's interesting, and Nika particularly asked me to get involved with, is trying to incorporate technology into what we're doing. And I have spoken at three or four now of the Smart Kitchen Summits in various different countries to try and find a way that we can bring technology in. And we're just right at the beginning of this. And I think I sort of made a bit of a breakthrough in finally trying to work out the role of technology, because there is a sense that the techies make life far too complicated, which is what you two have been talking about. I'd like to introduce the word, or reintroduce the word, nudge. I think it's really helpful. I think if we can think of technology as nudging rather than subverting our natural way of shopping, for example. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm slightly worried about the Amazon-based fridge. I think it's interesting, but I think if we keep it down to the basics as a sort of nudging thing to keep your sort of household running, but not as the core inspiration for cooking, probably we're looking in the right direction, because you do not want to take out the joy of cooking. And I'm worried that Deliveroo is kind of also on the verge of possibly doing it. I'm not against Deliveroo, in the weekdays, but I want that kitchen at the weekend to be bloody well used,
And you want that to be spontaneous,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I think the nudge concept is an interesting one. I think you're certainly, in terms of the way the Internet of Things has reached into the home, it still hasn't been anywhere near as successful as we might have expected. And I think that is largely down to appropriateness of the way it's delivered. at the moment. And I think that perhaps the multi-generational point of thinking is how do you find the common theme that works across the largest group and utilize that as a key driver for whatever you're creating, and avoid the trap of trying to solve every problem.
But that's the next step, isn't it? So, yeah. I mean, at the moment, all these sort of Internet of Things ideas, starting with the various different voice-operated things you can get for the house and so on, but they're all quite niche in themselves at the moment. You have to be quite techie or have been sold a particular idea about it in order to even have one, and then you've got to start thinking about changing your light bulbs or your this, that, and the other. But I imagine when people start, these start to normalise as concepts rather than just being a niche, new, techie idea, there will be ways in which they will actually be hugely useful for the grey market or for accessibility or whatever. Because if you can just voice operate things, then clearly it will help, well, I imagine.
A classic example of that is for the very top end of the market, Neffer, soon to launch, which the group Siemens already have done, ovens that you can totally operate from your iPhone. Mm. And this was done purely for the very top end of the market. But actually, what they didn't even realise, and which they're finding out, is the people who are going to use this mode are probably disabled people who, you know, if you don't have to physically pull the door down to operate your oven, and you can program it, and you're not having to try and work, you know, push buttons, etc., to turn your oven on and off. You know, what a great.
How does the iPhone get your chicken out of the fridge?
Yeah.
Well, no, see, that's the great thing. That's through good design. So what you design is you design a worktop at right angles to your fridge so that you can just slide something straight from your fridge onto the worktop.
But even simpler things there can be, you know, can the front of the appliance give you some indication of how hot it is without needing to go and look at the precise temperature or give you a better understanding? I mean, it's not difficult to know when a pan is going to boil over, for example, and the system to respond appropriately.
Incidentally, we Newcastle University has a very interesting focus group, which you two, if you're ever interested, I think might want to plug into. It's called Voice North. Mm-hmm. And we ran workshops. They're basically retired engineers, people, professionals who give their time free. And they're a very thoughtful group of people. And we spent 2 days in a disused church in Newcastle looking at some multi-generational ideas. And then we sort of put them around round tables and we got them to kind of answer specific questions and debate ideas. The obvious news is that when voice activation is made really effective, they won't feel threatened by tech anymore. So you won't have that problem of introducing tech to the grey market. But also there were a number of things that they came up with which were very helpful and slightly unexpected and fun. So I really recommend using them for doing your research. I mean, a particular finding we discovered was everybody wants a view out of their kitchen window. They can't bear being, you know, sort of locked in. And actually, if you look at what neuroscientists tell you, they'll say that seeing a long view triggers off, whether you want it or not, relaxed feelings. It's quite interesting. So. There was quite a wide response, but the other thing was they wanted a hot seat. You know, grandma, granddad, although they're going to be participating in all this, they actually want to be completely involved in going, and they're going to hang out in the kitchen because that's going to be the place where, you know, where they can be the most sort of, you know, nurtured and loved.
Can I just sort of take things back a step? I think Adam, you mentioned about universities perhaps not encouraging accessible design or multi-generational design, and my experience working with students at A-level, teaching product design at A-level, was that they were really engaged with that topic, and often, you know, I would do lots of different projects with them throughout the first year of their sixth form, including accessible design-based projects, and they then had free choice for their major project at the end, and it's really interesting that, you know, probably in a year group, 50% of those students went back to that type of project.
Which is fantastic.
And the outcomes were usually the most effective.
And my question would be, so is that organised on a national level by whoever organises the curriculum, or is that because you're a good egg and you understand the benefits of it?
It wasn't built into the curriculum. Yeah. I mean, ergonomics, usability.
But it is brilliant. Like, and again, I'm sure if you asked your students, and how many of your students in a room of 30 were personally touched by impairment or disability through age or whatever, and you'll find probably a third of those students would be. I mean, we find with our students for the third year project, when we ask them to actually do a project on accessible design, and they've got to come up with an imaginary disabled person. Two-thirds of them basically base it on a member of their own family.
They've got one handy, you know,
and they've got a client, a real client that they can talk to.
Yeah.
They can iterate different designs, 3D print them, take them to the client in inverted commas and get feedback. And it, you know, I always encourage the students that weren't quite sure which direction to go with a project down that route. You know, can you find someone within your family who has mobility issues or early onset dementia or something like that, and think of a way of solving a problem for them,
which is brilliant.
And they were, you know, really engaged in that.
Well, Adam and I are also working in another area which kind of slightly addresses this issue, which is the Royal Society of Arts do this, as you probably know, the Student Design Challenge. And I haven't really worked out just how much it's a fast route to sort of almost like education, sorry, to innovation via the university system, because we can put a brief together, which is completely topical. We've just done one right now. It's just, we're launching it next week. And, you know, probably 1,000 students will do that design. Only 100 will probably enter the competition. But you've already, all those design tutors are starting to think, oh, you know, multi-generational kitchens is what it is in our case. Oh, that's something we should be looking at. Because, you know, you try setting up a course on multi-generational kitchen design, it'll take you 5 years.
Yeah.
So that is, I think, something that one way we can try and, if you like, speed up areas of design that we think, well, needed.
I'm conscious of time, unfortunately. I think this is very fascinating, but we're going to have to bring it to a close. If I could just have a couple of thoughts from each of you, just to sort of take home message for the listeners of the sorts of things you want people to think about. Adam, why don't you go first?
My thought is always go and research, or go and find out what the social model of disability is. Because I think this is a very good way. I came about it through a lovely chap when I first got involved with disability politics called Mike Oliver. And basically, the easy to understand definition of the social model of disability is that my impairment doesn't stop me going and watching a film. What stops me watching a film is the flight of stairs. So if you design a cinema without a flight of stairs, I can go and watch that film in exactly the same way as anybody else. And if we can try and get that thought, that design concept, which is basically the social model of disability, into designers and town planners' heads, then I think half the battle will be won.
Thank you. Johnny, where do you go next, as your involvement is related to that?
I feel I've already said too much. I guess I would like people to, next time they're playing in a kitchen, to think about it really carefully as a much bigger opportunity and not accept just basically a bunch of units around a wall. But what you can do to make people feel, translate emotions in into the actual physical space, you know, opening it up to your garden, putting a French door in, that may be more important than almost anything else. So yeah, translating emotions into design. I know that sounds a bit sort of too professional. But
it's broader than kitchen design.
Very much so. Let me leave you with this lovely thought. There's a Japanese concept called wahisabi, which probably most designers know about, which is about the role of imperfection and time and age into the things they surround themselves with, and getting more from this object than just purely its function. Choose things that conform to wahisabi. Go out and buy a book on wahisabi and explore.
Matt?
Well, obviously, colleagues that are much more experienced of multi-generational design, but from the perspective of designing simple consumer products, I mean, just making sure that the user interface is simple, whether you're using complex tech to do that or more basic sort of analog control, is really important, just so that you're not limiting the market for your product, and you know, people of all ages, all abilities can use it.
Thank you, Matt. And Martin, finally.
I'd go back to the point that I think design is so driven by context, really, and I think the interesting opportunity about multidisciplinary design is it makes you think of a wider context, and then it sets a challenging problem for designers, which is how do you find a better thing which applies to a wider population. And then the tricky part is then converting that into a commercial opportunity that gets people to engage in it. So the more we talk about it, the better. The more we can show examples of it that inspire people, the better, really, and the more we can champion, you know, as Apple would say, you know, not making things different, but making things better, the better we will be, really.
Great. And I suppose the final obligatory word from the lawyer is, it's all very well having all these having all these brilliant ideas, but what you don't want to do is put all that work in and then somebody come and copy it. So I would encourage all listeners to look at the webpage you will have found this podcast from, which is gowlingwlg.com/designsforlife. There are other podcasts on there as well. You can hear much more from Martin, but also from a plethora of other designers. And there's also some helpful and free guides on how to protect yourself to make sure that you do think about IP protection at an early stage, because if you don't, then all this good work might well get taken from underneath you, which would be a pity given how much thought clearly goes into the good design. Thank you all very much for your time today, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.